Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And as I said, we're going to be turning our attention to some new things here, as we're going to be talking about solar energy today and get an update on what's going on at the Wisconsin Energy Institute. A couple of guests for you today. Greg Nemeth, a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the UW-Madison, the author of the soon-to-be-released book, How Solar Became Cheap. Greg, good to have you here.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
And with us as well, Mary Blanchard, Associate Director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And Mary, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thanks for having us.
Well, appreciate it very much. If you have some questions as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And you know what, Mary, before we even get going on solar, why don't you talk a little bit about the Wisconsin Energy Institute and what it's all about?
Great. Thank you for the opportunity. So the Wisconsin Energy Institute is based on UW-Madison's campus, and it's working to develop sustainable alternatives to meet society's ever-growing need for power, fuels, and chemicals. So we really work hard to generate the knowledge and clean technologies that can help move us to a sustainable, resilient, and affordable energy future. We do this in several ways. We foster collaborative energy projects across disciplines. We prepare energy leaders of today and tomorrow, and we also work to enhance public understanding of energy issues. We support more than 160 energy-related researchers on UW-Madison's campus, and also a very large federally funded research center called Great Lakes Bioenergy.
Yeah, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Institute. And Greg, maybe talk about how your work intersects with...
Yeah, I work with the Wisconsin Energy Institute and have since it started. I'm at the School of Public Affairs, and I teach courses on energy analysis there and work with the Energy Analysis and Policy Program. And, you know, we do a lot of the effort there is to be working on energy from an interdisciplinary cross-campus perspective. So we've got engineers taking policy courses. We've got environmental studies students that have to learn about technology. We've got policy students that are working on understanding environmental systems. It's designed to get breadth, and the Wisconsin Energy Institute's a perfect kind of hub for all of that activity to come together.
Absolutely. Well, and you have a book coming out in June. It's called How Did Solar Become So Cheap? Maybe quantify cheap for me first.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah. I mean, the book is come from, I've been working on solar since 2002. And at the time when I started working on it, it was considered an interesting technology that had some elegant physical characteristics, but was never a serious way to deal with our energy problems. And that last part has changed. And in the last few years, it's become so cheap that we can now talk about using solar as a way to deal with energy supply, to deal with some of the problems with the way we produce energy from fossil fuels, and even use it in a big way in Wisconsin because it's become so cheap. So now the cheapest solar in the world, and the units we use are dollars per megawatt hour, and that's a megawatt hour is about what a household uses in a month here. So it's like your monthly electricity bill. And when the first data I have for solar in the 1950s was that was $300,000 a month. That would be electricity bill if you use solar in 1957 when it started. And that's come down steadily over time. And now in certain places of the world where it's sunny, it's $20. So the average U.S. electric bill is about $110, $120 a month. So you can do it for $20 in the sunniest place. And that is the cheapest way that humans have ever produced electricity at scale. Not the cheapest way to ever produce solar or renewables, the cheapest way to produce electricity. So that's dramatic and it's serious and it's a big deal now.
So how did you measure the value of, talk a little bit more about measuring the value.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is just to look at how the costs have come down. But a lot of what the book was about was really to understand why it's gotten so cheap. What were the factors that led to it to become so cheap? And because maybe we can use that as a model to apply to other technologies. So solar's helpful to have cheap solar now. That doesn't directly help us with cars. So how do we get cheap batteries and cheap electric vehicles? How do we deal with maybe doing cheap nuclear power? How do we do with cheap ways of capturing carbon from the atmosphere? So the idea here is that the real value of solar may not just be that we have cheap solar electricity now. It may be that we can apply that lesson to other technologies that we know we will need. So that's a lot of what I try to do in the book was understand how solar got cheap and to think about how that provides lessons for other technologies.
As we look at how solar is being used, how generally is it being used today? We're seeing more in households, but...
Yeah, it's growing quickly. It's been happening in households, in a lot of places since the 1970s. It's grown in different places. Initially in Japan in the 1990s was the first household solar. Then Germany was the leader in the 2000s. Then the U.S., especially California, New Jersey, and Arizona in the last 10 years, and then China since 2011. And then in Wisconsin, we've actually got solar happening in households in a scale that wasn't happening before in the last couple of years. And then really dramatically in the last 2 months, we've got bids and plans for very large solar installations, and two of which have just been approved, and there's something like a couple dozen more projects in the offing, which would be the size of, you know, a regular power plant that you would see burning natural gas or coal. And so that's a big difference to actually have this happening in Wisconsin, where we have half as much sunlight as in Arizona or somewhere like that. So that, to me, is an indication of how broad an impact solar is happening, and where it's not just in sunny places that can take advantage of it. It's even here.
I'll just add that the community solar or grid level solar that Greg is talking about, a lot of people are wanting to bid in and help own part of that. If their home isn't appropriate for having solar on their rooftop, that there is an opportunity for people to participate with their utility as part of community solar.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing to have. As a matter of fact, are the solar panels, I mean, are they just doing a much better job of collecting that sunlight, or what's going
on? That's part of the story. So the efficiency of them, so how much sunlight they shines on them and how much of that is turned into electricity has improved. It's doubled approximately in the last 30 years or so. So that makes a difference. If you double how much electricity, that cuts the cost in half. So that's helped. But the cost has come down way more than half. It's come down by something like a factor of 1,000 over the last few decades. And so it's other things like that. It's what seem like minor adjustments making a big difference. It's things like slicing the silicon ingots, that's where the panels come from, thinner and thinner. So you can get many more wafers, which is what a solar panel is made of, out of the same amount of material. It's finding ways to make that material and purify silicon cheaper, and that's made a difference as well. And then it's a lot of it is just manufacturing processes. So working in facilities, making them bigger, there's economies of scale from doing that, and just finding small tweaks here and there along the way that make a really big difference. And, you know, part of this is an international phenomenon. One kind of revealing anecdote I learned in talking to lots of people in my book was that China has done a lot in producing low-cost solar in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, when you would start a new factory in China to produce solar, you would go to the semiconductor industry, people working to make computer memory chips and processors, and hire those people and get them to, because they know how to work with silicon, and get them to work and produce solar. If you talk to someone last year, I remember talking to someone, he said he would never, if someone had that on their resume, he would tell them to go away and would never hire anyone from the computer industry with solar, because now what they want is people that are have experience with making handbags and T-shirts and really, really inexpensive products with very low margins, but can be produced at massive scale. And that's what solar looks like today. So when we think about how solar's gotten cheap, it's been an array of factors. But some of them is that. It's learning from other sectors. It's taking people that have skills in other areas and applying them to this technology. And, you know, I think it's been dramatic what's happened.
I think there's another hurdle that needs to be overcome, that the panels have gotten very cheap, as Greg is saying, and that now there's more of a focus from the U.S. Department of Energy on how to reduce what are called the soft costs. So the cost of installing the solar, and that how do we reduce all of those pieces too? So that would be the next challenge.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. Bob in Appleton, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, what do you know about this surcharge that is being talked about now for solar, home solar installation. I know We Energy, I understand, has been talking about surcharging up. If you have home solar, you get an additional, We Energy imposed tax on solar. How does that impact pricing?
Yeah, that's a good question to raise. Just to give some context on this, a lot of the way that we use and pay for electricity is based on how a system looked in the 1920s and 1930s. It's really a lot of the same regulations where one company gets a monopoly on a certain service territory, and the Public Utility Commission or Public Service Commission approves what the rates will be. And there's no competition, but we get fair rates because the regulators decide what the rates will be. That's the model we've had for 90 years. And now we've got new technologies where people are producing their own electricity. And so this question arises, how do we deal with someone who wants to produce their own electricity, but still someone has to pay for all the distribution system and maintaining the grid? And households usually want to still retain a connection because they can't produce their own electricity all the time. And so when we talk about surcharges, that's a way to make up for some of that difference that used to get paid for when people are buying electricity from the utility. Now, the question is, what would be a fair surcharge? And I think that's when you really get in the devil's in the details. So I think it's completely legitimate to have a surcharge when you're using the grid, when you have your solar system. But the extent to which that surcharge is kind of fair and reflects the real costs, that's really going to be up to regulators. It's going to really be up to people at the Public Service Commission to make really smart decisions, have lots of people collecting data from other states and understanding what the real issues are. And that's a challenge.
And Bob, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We are talking today about solar energy, giving you an update with Greg Nemeth, professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the UW-Madison. He's authoring a book soon to be released called How Solar Became Cheap. And with us as well, Mary Blanchard. She's the associate director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. We are going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with our two guests. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this quick look at the news. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Solar energy is becoming cheap, and we're talking about why with our guests today. In the studio with me, Mary Blanchard, the Associate Director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute, and also Greg Nemeth. Greg's a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. So great to have both of them along. You may have some questions about solar technology. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Mary and Greg, we have Matt, who's been waiting a bit from Stevens Point, so let's go to Matt. Thank you very much for calling, Matt.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I'm a geotech engineer in Point. I went to school in Madison and at the geological engineering program there. We did, they had some emphasis on, you know, green power, which is awesome that they're doing even more of that now. But anyways, some of the most awesome projects I got to work on in the last few years was doing the foundation design for some solar panel arrays around the Driftless area. And that was in 2016 under the Obama administration. And the big clients were big power companies that burned coal, you know, because most of the state obviously gets their energy from coal. And at that time, they were basically building these small arrays because if they got a small percentage of their power from green energy like solar, they'd get tax write-offs. So that was kind of they're obviously still burning plenty of coal. But I was just curious, now under the Trump administration, you know, is there still big incentives for larger, you know, commercial power operations to get some of their power from solar or wind?
All right, Matt, good question. Thank you. And Greg, let's turn to you for that.
Yeah, sure. So some big changes in the federal government in the last couple of years since your experience in 2016. But one thing that hasn't changed is there is still a 30% tax credit for solar installations, and that's true at the residential scale, but also at commercial scale and at larger scale too. So that makes a big difference. So if you're a residential customer thinking about doing solar, that's about a $10,000 system that would go on your house, and you're going to get $3,000 taken right off your taxes. So it's not something where you get a portion of that back, you get all of that back. So that's a pretty big difference, and that's true at commercial scale. And then in that case, you know, maybe it's 10 times as big a system, and so you're talking about a $30,000 tax credit, something like that. So, so the incentives are still there, but there is a plan to ramp down the incentives over the next few years so that they'll be in the 20s next year and then low 20s after that in terms of percent deduction. So there still are incentives, but they are made to go away because the cost of solar is coming down and we don't need as many. The one other thing, though, that you mentioned with coal, I mean, that's something to keep an eye on as well. So the last data that I saw after having shut down some pretty big coal plants in the last couple of years, Wisconsin now gets less than half of its electricity from coal. It's just under 50%. So it used to be true that most of our electricity comes from coal, and you no longer can say that because we've got more natural gas, more wind, and a bit of solar, which is growing pretty quickly. So there are some changes happening, despite that, you know, it's not necessarily being led by the federal government.
Yeah, I'll just quickly add that I just saw notice that in April, renewables generated more electricity than coal nationally. So that's sort of an interesting crossover point.
Very interesting. That happened this last year, you said?
Just this past April.
Oh, there we go. Thanks, Matt. Appreciate the call. Ron in Madison, it's your turn.
You said it costs $20 at the best sites for photovoltaic electricity per megawatt hour. How much does it cost per megawatt hour equivalent for thermal solar, which is domestic hot water and space heating? For example, the Madison Fire Departments all have thermal solar on every fire station in the city. And how does that $20 compare to other sources of electricity? Like you just mentioned coal, there's nuclear, there's natural gas, there's hydropower and wind. Can they beat the $20 per megawatt hour? Thanks.
Yeah, just a brief.
Thanks, Ron.
Sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
If you can get $20 per megawatt hour solar, which is there are projects that are doing that today, that beats everything else. So I'll just say that. Nothing else competes with $20 per megawatt hour. So that's on the electricity side. But if you're using energy or solar energy to heat water, it's different units. That's a really good question. I'm not sure how it compares to it. I guess what you'd want to compare is how does putting solar hot water panels on your roof compared to the alternative, which is buying gas from the utility and burning that in your basement to heat up water. And I'm not sure actually how it comes down now. Gas is pretty inexpensive, and there hasn't been quite as much innovation on the solar hot water heaters as there has been in the more electrical generating solar style. But, you know, it probably does make sense if you've got the right roof facing south and you use quite a bit of hot water. It's just not been as dramatic a change as with the electricity generating solar.
Yeah, I'll just quickly add, I have some data here in front of me that is showing that natural gas, at least for electricity generation, is about 5.75 cents per kilowatt hour compared to solar. These are 2018 numbers at 4.2.
Okay, so that's just to put it in the units of $20. So that's $57 for natural gas and $40 for solar in Wisconsin.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks for that question, Ron. Appreciate it. David and Slinger, we'll go to you next. Hi, David.
Hello. I think it was a few years ago, read something about shingles for houses for solar energy. Has that gone anywhere? It seems like that would be kind of a neat sort of thing. You know, it doesn't jump off the roof, and it's if it works well. So I just wanted to know what your thoughts were.
That's a good question, too. Thank you, David.
I'll just quickly say that when I started working in renewable energy about 13 years ago, there were companies then that were working to try to make shingles that would be solar panels. Many of them have gone out of business. I know that the Tesla Corporation is looking at this as well, you know, so in conjunction with their home battery, the power walls and those types of things. So I think it is something that people are continuing to work on.
Yeah. Yeah. Greg, anything?
Yeah, I mean, the data that I've looked at shows a few percent of U.S. systems are this shingle-style solar. So it's something I think a lot of people find appealing and attractive. And as the caller mentioned, you know, it doesn't stick out from the roof as much as panels would. It's just hard to do it quite as cheaply. And so far that the panels have beaten the shingles on that. So they are more expensive to do the shingles. But, yeah, it's something that's happening. But you can imagine getting even more creative with how we apply solar. And, you know, it's not out of the question to think of, you know, doing solar stick and being able to shape it and not have that. And then at some point, it's also coding. Or a spray. I think once we really get more creative about using it, you could see even more applications. So this idea of just having these flat panels and boxes around is kind of the way most things work today, but that's unlikely to stay that way for a long time.
It'd be interesting, you know, the three of us are sitting here 20 years from now talking about this. I think what we'd have to say or what you'd have to say would be a lot different.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we just kind of have it assimilated as just another thing. Like we have coal and gas plants around. We just have solar in a lot of places. And, yeah, it'd be, I think, just kind of matter of fact.
Wayne in – thanks again, Jan. Wayne in Marshfield, we'll go to you next. Hi, Wayne.
My concern is how friendly is Wisconsin to solar energy? NPR had a program within the last week. Somebody in Alabama had put in a home solar, spent $8,000. And then the utility slapped this huge minimum, whether it was used or not, to be hooked onto the grid. And it was a negative experience.
Yeah. You want to comment on that? Greg?
Yeah. I mean, I think this goes back to this issue about the regulation of electric power is from the 1930s, and we've done very little to modernize it since. There was efforts in the 70s and again in the 1990s, but each time there were really limited efforts or limited outcomes in terms of trying to incorporate new sources of electricity, making things more competitive, having prices come into people's decision-making. And none of that has stuck very much except in a few places, but not here. And so we're in a new round of this. We've got new technologies now that are distributed, wind, solar, and it's going to really come down to – I think it all comes down to the Public Service Commission. They are really at the center of making decisions that reflect – making sure that the electric utilities can provide service to their customers at just and reasonable rates and that the utilities can earn a return, but that we allow people to make the choices that they want to have in terms of how they use electricity, where it comes from, but increasingly whether and how they produce electricity, in which solar allows that, and with electric vehicles could allow a bit of storage as well. And so I think it really comes down to the decisions and the people at the Public Service Commission to really make sense of a really difficult and fast-changing environment. And it really comes down to them in terms of answering the caller's question about whether Wisconsin will be a friendly and competitive state for new technologies like solar or not. And I think it would be focused on that.
And thanks again, Wayne, for calling. Now let's go to Jan in Madison. Jan, hi. Thank you for waiting.
Well, thank you so much, Larry. Being the farmer's daughter, I'm always concerned with land use. And I really applaud both using solar and wind. But here's my question. Wouldn't it be better to go with wind? Because the wind towers take up really very little area, and farmers can still use their fields for food production. And then one other thing. I see the U.S. using these wonderful, fertile fields for solar. And then in Germany, oftentimes they're along the roadsides. So those are my two questions, comments.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Jan. Appreciate it.
We recently had a program looking at energy and landscapes in Wisconsin and had a number of people coming to talk about this as an issue. And I think even some faculty members came on Larry's show to talk about it as well. And that I think one of the things when we think about using farmland for solar is that there is an opportunity to grow other kinds of cover crops, some crops underneath the solar panels, or to use the land for sheep or other kinds of animals, and that they're at the end of the solar panel's lifespan, you know, useful lifespans, they can be taken up, and the soil might be in even better condition than it was before, and then you can go back to growing food on the land, and so that it's not a permanent change to that land the same way that it would be like when you put in a road, you've really changed the land underneath that road, you know, so that there are some options for, long-term benefits of having the solar, but then still being able to go back to growing crops on those fields.
So those panels, they're not close to the ground. They're typically raised up quite a ways.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the land use issue is a big deal. I'm glad that Jan raises it. And I think her question too points to the fact that it can be done badly and it can be done well. You can do it on marginal land, or you can do it on the most fertile cropland. And so clearly there's some better and worse ways to do it. I guess I'd also think about diversifying incomes for farmers. So, you know, farmers take a lot of risk. They're at risk of weather, they're at risk of disease, and they're certainly at risk at agricultural markets and the prices they get for their crops. And to be able to diversify that risk by having some land set aside for producing electricity, whether for wind or solar or maybe some combination, it seems to me not a bad way, especially if you can be careful about how you do it so that you have a lower impact on the land and the landscape than a bigger one.
Jan, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We'll give Jeremy a chance to join in from Racine next. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. In regards to solar, are we looking anywhere around the horizon on a more scalable models, more lower scale models for people who rent, being able to have more portability, more self-containing unit without having to have an entire grid on top of a home? If you're renting a property and let's say you want to run your refrigerator and a few household appliances, instead of having such a large scalable grid on your roof, something small, portable, the average renter can plug in to the unit and voila.
Yeah, interesting question. Greg, let's go to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. One of the tricky but very solid facts about solar is that bigger is cheaper. So the cheapest way to make electricity, when I said $20 a megawatt hour, is doing utility scale. So these giant fields of panels. And then the next cheapest is doing community solar. So on an industrial building where you have maybe 200 households worth of solar. And then it's more expensive to do one household of solar. And then it's even more expensive, which I try to do in my house, to do half a roof of solar. So that as you have bigger scale, you can spread the fixed costs and you can get discounts from the manufacturer and from the people installing them. So you can do portable. You can do any scale at all. It's possible. It just tends to be more expensive. But, you know, that's one thing that I realized has been one of the big successes of solar is that you can do – there's a factor of a billion from the smallest scale solar, which is what you'd find in a calculator or a watch, and the big facilities that are being planned, actually, a couple in Wisconsin. Anything in between can be used and has been used. And so it's just a matter of people's willingness to pay, and it's generally a bit more expensive at smaller scale. So you could do something portable and small scale. It's not quite as cheap as doing it larger and more fixed.
Thanks very much for calling, Jeremy. You could join in, too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. I've often thought, wouldn't it be cool to have on top of your car a solar unit somehow that would just keep powering that electric vehicle?
Yeah.
Any chance that's ever going to happen?
Well, I will say that there is a competition that actually I have been told brings in college students from around the world looking at developing solar cars, and that they, you know, are obviously using the hood space, the roof space, every aspect of it, and really concerned about the lightweight nature of the vehicle as well. And part of what they do in this competition, we don't happen to have a team that works on this here at UW-Madison, but I know that Minnesota does, and I'm not sure other colleges across the country, but that then the students take it on a cross-country trek where it's about a three-week effort to have the car operate entirely by solar to go, you know, all the way to the West Coast. So it's a very interesting endeavor that the students do.
Yeah.
I love that idea.
Yeah.
Someone who owns a hybrid, you know, it's I've often thought, gosh, it'd be nice if we could put a panel up there. and run. Well, what is doable, do you think, in the next few years?
Well, I mean, I have my own little experience with that. So about a year ago, I was kind of getting stuck with the book. I really wasn't getting enough done on it. And it was I thought, I really just need to get away and just focus on the book for a week or so. So I took my little camper van and went to a campground about an hour and a half from here and just just wrote for a week. But I realized what kind of made me sad is that after a day or so, I needed to move to a campsite that had an electrical hookup and plug in so I could charge my laptop. And that kind of got me saying that's not quite right. So the next week, a friend and former student, Andy Lick, and I installed a solar panel on my little camper van and got it going. And I think it was kind of a nice process to go through of working through and realizing – I guess one is like that's serious electricity that is getting produced from something that looks simple, even on this tiny scale. And so it gave me a lot of respect for the people that are doing the installations. It's the roofers and electricians and how the power system works. It's not just a toy. It's not quite the same as a watch or a calculator. It's something that's producing serious power. And I think that's a lesson for what's happening with solar. It's actually a serious technology now that's starting to disrupt how we make electricity, creating a need to rethink how we do regulation. I mean, it's even promoting was a big part of a trade dispute between the U.S. and China. That was something under the Obama administration in 2012 and under the Trump administration last year, putting tariffs on Chinese panels. And so I think that, if anything, is an indicator that solar's kind of time has come and it's now serious, is that it's creating that type of international and geopolitical impact.
Well, now everybody else who does similar kinds of camping things is wanting to know, how much did that cost you, an arm and a leg to do that?
The panel was $100, and then I had to figure out what kind of battery to get. And I said, well, I just want to charge my blender. And so we called a friend in Mexico who had been living out of their van for a while. And he said, well, he's definitely going to want a big enough battery to run a blender. So I don't know. I haven't tried the blender yet, but it worked for the laptop, what I've got. But yeah, it's pretty cheap now. You can go out and buy a panel for $100 and hook it up with a few more dollars of wires and things like that. It's pretty neat.
And tell us now about the book that you got coming out.
Yeah, so the book was, you know, I've been looking at solar data and doing econometrics and statistics on solar since 2002 and really trying to understand why solar has gotten so cheap. One of the things I've kind of, it's been nagging me over the years is that I always felt like they were variables, data that I couldn't actually get. It was hard to turn into numbers, hard to measure, hard to put into a econometric model. And so the idea here was to do something different, is to go talk to people and talk to people in lots of different places and then talk to people kind of in a historical perspective to see how things evolved over time. And so, yeah, that involved talking to 75 people, like hour plus interviews with 75 people in 18 countries to understand their role and what happened. And that, it just really was instructive. I definitely learned a lot that wasn't in the data that I'd seen before or in other people's papers. I mean, for example, one of the conversations I thought was most interesting is there was a guy that started a solar company in China in 2000 and became the richest person in China and went through how that all happened. And it was pretty scrappy and entrepreneurial. So
now the title of the book and how do people get it?
How Solar Energy Became Cheap. And it's on Amazon and will be available in 2 weeks.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what, I'm looking forward to seeing that book. Really? Thank you so much, Mary and Greg, for being with us today. And we'll get them back and we'll do this again. It was a lot of fun.
Great.
Greg Nemeth is professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the UW-Madison, and his new book, soon to be released, How Solar Became Cheap. Mary Blanchard, Associate Director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Definitely we'll have them back and we'll do this again. Tomorrow, Scott Craven will be back with us, and we'll talk about a wildlife ecology camp, bats, and turtle nesting, among other things. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store.